welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. Nobody does programs like this. Please consider helping us continue over at patreon.com/thepopularpod. Welcome back to the show, Professor Peter Dale Scott, the Berkeley poet, the man who brought the term the deep state into Western political discourse, and the academic who has done most to lend scholarly credence to skepticism about the official version of the Kennedy assassination, 9/11, and much else in recent American history. But that is not what we're discussing today. Today, our subject is one of Professor Scott's most recent books. It's called Ecstatic Pessimist, Czeslaw Milosz, Poet of Catastrophe and Hope. Professor Scott, welcome to The Popular Show. I'm going to hold up my copy for the video as well. There we are. Snap. We both got it. Very beautiful object published by Roman and Littlefield. I don't know at what point in one's life people stop skirting around the question of one's age and instead start mentioning it with impunity. But I think you must be there. I'm going to tell listeners right off that you're 95 years old.
That's right. Yes.
You had a birthday recently.
In about 3 weeks.
Many happy returns. I say this, you're not only the most senior guest I've ever interviewed on this show, I suspect you're the most senior person to appear on any podcast ever.
Oh, I don't know about that. Possibly. I don't know. I can't think of someone else, but...
Well, I say this in gratitude, really, that your determination throughout your life to ask the really difficult questions, to pursue the really difficult research that must have made you a lot of enemies in your time. And, well, a lot of people have not come out of this kind of research alive, to put it quite frankly. And you've also been pursuing literature all your life. I suspect that the reason why you are still working so hard at your time of life is that these two missions that you've set yourself are ones that are never really over.
Yes, though, I cannot be the researcher I was. I have to accept that at 95, there's some things my brain doesn't do as well as it used to. My eyesight is bad. I'm not good at interviewing because my hearing without these things is not good, despite hearing aids. But I am in a position to meditate and reflect, and I do a great deal of that. And that seems to come. I think the brain adapts itself to doing that in my age group. So I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'm still working.
Have you found that the audience or the demographic of people who are seeking your advice on American history has changed? I interviewed you on the Deep State back in 2021. Since then, I've heard you on TrueAnon and American Exception. These podcasts and independent media shows run by much younger people from a left-wing background. I mean, it was only sort of 10, 15 years ago that Alex Jones was the person most likely to be inviting you on for interviews. Has your audience moved to the left, or how would you see that?
The audience is partly my fault, but it's shrunk. I had two books come out. I've been working on two books in the last 6 months. And I have basically been saying no to interview requests, except from people I know very well, like Aaron Good, who I've worked with and has helped me in other ways besides interviewing me. So it was partly voluntary. I think it's mostly voluntary. I do think that another feature of aging is that as I'm less good at a researcher, I like thinking out loud. It's always been true for me that to do an interview helps me with my own thinking, because the questions I should have been asking myself get asked by people like you, and that's a great benefit to me. So I enjoy this.
Let's talk about Milosz. For the listeners to this show, it's mainly a political audience, so sometimes I have to get people up to speed on cultural issues and questions of the literary canon. Milos, one of the most celebrated poets of the second half of the 20th century, he was part of the resistance in Poland against Nazi occupation. Then he was opposed to the Stalinist leadership of the Polish People's Republic. He finally defected to the US, joining the literature faculty in Berkeley in 1960. He would later win the Nobel Prize in 1980. Were you already at Berkeley when Milos arrived there?
No, it's the other way around. He came 1 year before I did. And he did, you know, his decision to defect was really made in 1950. And he decided to do it in France, not because he wanted to live in France. He hoped that he would move very quickly from France to America. But because he had worked for the post-war Polish government before it really defined itself as being communist, he was outlawed. He could not come according to the act that had been passed just before he came, actually, or wanted to come. But he was finally invited in 1960 by the University of California. And the act that had prevented him coming had been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So this time he could finally come. He had wanted to come 10 years before, but wasn't able to. He couldn't be invited.
It will surprise some of our listeners who know you principally for your work on the Kennedy assassination that you had already done some of your most historically consequential stuff before Kennedy was killed. Early in the 60s, you began work with Milos there in Berkeley. Can you describe what it was like working with someone like that? Did you already regard him as the genius that you clearly do regard him as in this book, or was he just a colleague who needed a hand with the translation?
Well, my interest in him was at that time mostly just poetical. By an extraordinary stroke of luck, I was the Canadian government paid for me to hire a tutor when I got to Poland. I was only there for 2 years, but I did not know Polish when I arrived, really. So they paid for a tutor, and the tutor was a former lover of the other great candidate for Nobel Prize from Poland, who was Zbigniew Herbert. And Herbert and I met Herbert only once, but we talked about Milos. As I was a cultural attaché for the Canadian Embassy in Poland, I met a lot of poets. They all talked about Milos and his importance. So it was just a stroke of luck that I got a job at the University of California, Berkeley, and he was there. When I met him, he was not yet known in America. He was quite famous in Poland and to a certain extent in Europe. But he had not been translated into English. The first of his poems to be translated into English was translated by me. And I'd like to say, if it's mostly a political audience, that my interest in him began as a poetic interest, but it became in time a political interest because he was very interested in politics. And I've always been committed to nonviolence as the way to develop a politics that will help the country instead of, as so often, not the country, the world. But politics is so often the source of our discontents and our disruptions that he had a vision of a way to make it better. And I should have worked this in at the very beginning, that I think Milos will be remembered chiefly someday as a man who inspired the Solidarity movement in Poland, which by a very skilled, nonviolent and disciplined approach was able to force the removal from its country of the largest land army in the world. So that is, I think, one of the, we've had a depressing century of politics in many ways, what's called the Pax Americana after the Pax Britannica the century before. It was a time of peace at home, but almost endless warfare elsewhere. And I have to say, slavery, we've abolished chattel slavery, but we still have wage slavery in appalling conditions in the rest of the world. And Miłosz was, to me, a breath of fresh air, that solidarity to me was very, very helpful. The civil rights movement in America and then the solidarity movement in Poland really gave me hope that there was a way out of the political mess that we have to admit we are in right now. And in the short run, it seems to be getting worse.
The book is both a masterful work of literary criticism and an outstanding introduction to this important poet. It is a very moving memoir, and I'm going to, if you don't mind, ask you about some of the personal things in there as we proceed. And it's also an attempt to reconcile, I think, Miłosz's politics with your own, along lines that you've just described. Yeah. But at the time of your relationship, there was a lot more discord between you, inevitably, as a Polish emigre and as an anti-communist dissident. Miłosz was not particularly impressed with the activities of the New Left in America, and this was really your milieu at that time in opposition to the Vietnam War, and I suppose what in retrospect must seem like the sort of build-up to the realizations and the critique of how American governance works in the 20th century that you would later pursue much more programmatically. Could you tell us something about those political disagreements that you had in the 60s before we you try to reconcile them?
Before we had the disagreements, we had a honeymoon period. I met him in the fall of 61, and until 67, there were, I think the disagreements began in 1964, which was a big year here in Berkeley, California. It was the year of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement and Mario Savio. Mario Savio, it was a, you know, I was much older, but I admired him. I thought he was a brilliant leader. His life after his leadership of the FSM never quite maintained itself. But when I wrote a book about the American deep state and wanted to end with a hopeful note, I included a very long poem of mine in praise of Mario Savio as another model of nonviolence. And Miłosz was a model of nonviolence. But we translated, and you know, I was about, he had not yet made many friends among poets. I think I was the first published poet who he trusted to translate with. And I was I'm very flattered now that when his rather important book, Postwar Polish Poetry, came out, which introduced the Western world to, or the English-speaking world to Polish poetry, he said some of the poems in his book were translated by Peter Dale Scott with my minor assistance. Hmm. Well, this Nobel Prize poet didn't continue to talk that way, but in that era he did. And then we had the free speech movement, which electrified. It was an event not just in Berkeley, but in America. And for all I know, I think was a factor in the Paris Spring of 1868 and so on. Because we had many French people here, and some of the planning of the Paris 1868 was done here in Berkeley. Berkeley became a kind of hotbed of alternative politics. But I think what was unfortunate was that Mimos had two sons who were just teenagers at that age of marijuana and sexual exploration and so on. And he was very disappointed to see them become drug users. The older son, Tony, whom I know, and is a very decent guy, but he got his interest in drugs was so great, he actually got a PhD in pharmacology because he believed proper use of drugs was the way to change the world. That, of course, divided the left. There were the people who thought that they would save the world through dropping out and tuning in. That's quoting Timothy Leary. I heard him make that statement at The Human Being in 1967. And then there were the other people who thought this was dropping out of the political conflict, where we had to keep all our marbles very sharp in our head to figure out what to do with the world. Well, Miłosz became eventually, it wasn't clear to me until 67, and then I know that date because that was the year that Miłosz saw me on a platform with Noam Chomsky. And he said after, well, what you said was not so bad, but that Chomsky, and I quote this in the book, he said, that Chomsky, he was one of those intellectuals who destroyed Weimar. With great emphasis. And I said, destroyed Weimar. Well, but you know, the United States is not Weimar. Weimar was set up in a very fragile condition. It was lucky it had lasted as long as it did, really, because there were so many internal enemies to it. You cannot compare America to Weimar. I think really was more than even the war issue, because he was not really a supporter of the Vietnam War. He was just a very grateful supporter of America, and he didn't like hearing people denigrating America. I myself tried never. I didn't want to denigrate America. I wanted to attack his foreign policy. And I continue to this day. I'm still a Canadian, by the way. I didn't want to swear allegiance to the American government. If anything, I would have taken an oath to try and overthrow it rather than an oath not to overthrow it. But I still think this is, as a country, the people, with its culture, full of conflicts, but the fact that it acts out its conflicts is the price you pay for being an active democracy. And so I've always been against governmental foreign policy and for America. And sometimes I trip myself up a bit, and very frequently I'll alienate one side or the other I try to maintain a balance, but even maintaining a balance is pretty offensive to some people in America nowadays.
I know that people have often found your own politics slightly, you know, difficult to truly pin down. The fact that you remain something of a patriot, albeit one who declined citizenship, whilst at the same time going further, frankly, than most people on the left are willing to go in the crimes that you're willing to accuse the United States government of. And really, it doesn't become simpler when we add your relationship to Miłosz into the equation. As I say, the book does a brave and impressive job of reconciling your two positions, and I respect that. At the same time, if you can allow me to just express some reservations about Miłosz. I've come to him through your work and through your relationship and admiration for him. I suppose the reason why it's taken so long is a basic mistrust on my part of that whole genre of anti-totalitarian and anti-communist literature. I mean, if you were somebody in Milosz's position who had fought the Nazis and then the Soviets come in and immediately start arresting the resistance members along with the Nazi officers there in Poland, of course that is going to rather colour your politics, to say the least. And yeah, I'm not going to say that somebody who doesn't want to live under a Stalinist party is wrong to hold that position. At the same time, there's a moment in The Captive Mind, Milosz's main programmatic contribution to that that anti-Stalinist, anti-communist genre, where Milosz says he finds it frustrating that his readers don't realize that there is a difference between Stalinism and leftism in general, and that what he's doing is a critique of Stalinism. That seems to me a very significant moment in the book, because that is the tragedy of anti-communism, that however well-intentioned and however reasonable many of the, especially émigré writers who contributed to that genre were, their problem is that, and I would extend this problem to Solidarity itself, the problem is that when you say we want to oppose the extremes of Stalinism, we want to oppose the violence and the control and the totalitarianism, but we want to replace it with our own democratic socialism, our own egalitarian, non-violent system. We don't merely want to import the American system here. The problem is that option wasn't available. And I mean, so, you know, to take a local example for me, George Orwell's 1984 or Animal Farm, he may have said that these were critiques of Stalinism, but their fate has been to be received as critiques of socialism as such, and then critiques of leftism as such, and finally as critiques of liberalism as such today. So I suppose I had a kind of reticence, even though I know fully convinced of Milosz's genius, even if I think that there is this kind of inbuilt sort of tragedy to the political project. But then yeah. when I come to your own position, I mean, I read here in another recent book of yours, The American Deep State, Big Money, Big Oil, and the Struggle for US Democracy. I quote from you here, Professor Scott, both scholars and ordinary Americans now look back with relief on McCarthyism and the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s, in the belief that we have outgrown such paranoia and disregard for law and human rights. But the personal excesses of McCarthy were surface manifestations of deeper illegal institutional procedures, mostly initiated by Hoover, which never really ended, and indeed have since proliferated to the point of being omnipresent. Hoover targeted leftists, the NSA targets everybody. So I suppose I put it to you that the sort of irresolvable, insoluble contradiction is that Milosz, with whatever intention and whatever high-minded aims and whatever genius, his main impact in America was to contribute to an anti-communist discourse which was instrumental in the setting up of the very deep state that you've spent most of your life attacking, documenting, and critiquing. Do you accept that there's a contradiction there? Is it something that you've had to get over, or do you see it differently?
Well, I think you'll see less of a problem if I make very clear at the beginning that although I'm a great admirer of Milosz, I'm not a great admirer of that book, The Captive Mind. And in fact, I had read it before I met Milosz, and it made me quite reserved when I first met Milosz, because The Captive Mind is essentially saying that all these people living under communism have learned how not to think honestly and to speak candidly. And I had just spent 2 years in Poland, admittedly, during the Polish thaw. So it was an ideal, the Polish thaw was the period after 1956 when things were relaxed and Gomułka, who the Stalinists had put in prison, came out and became the head of the government, or the head of the party, but that was the same thing. So I was just lucky to be there exactly when I was there. And these people did not have captive minds. They had the, I would say, the least captive minds of any community that I've ever been in. And by contrast, when I came to Berkeley, it's a brilliant university, but people, I think, were much more in debt and in the control of the sort of American commonplace idea that they were the ideal democracy as an exemplar for the rest of the country. There was far more self-questioning going on in Poland than there was in Berkeley. So mm-hmm. I did not admire that book. And if I can just begin to say what I think, and by the way, I didn't quite agree with your characterization of solidarity either, because the brilliance of solidarity was that publicly, at least, they had no political agenda. They arrived at a kind of understanding with the communists. We'll call it communists. They didn't. They considered themselves a socialist government. The agreement was that they would campaign for workers' rights and self-determination in the factories for their union leaders and so on, and stay out of state politics. And there was always a faction in Solidarity who were using Solidarity as a way to overthrow the government. But Solidarity had a strategy which was, I think, brilliantly nonviolent. And I think I have a whole chapter. In fact, the first substantive chapter in the book is how Miłosz helped set up Poland for Solidarity and what he called himself, he called his true art of politics, which was to be apolitical, and which I have a new book, by the way. It just came out. Oh, if I'm flashing books. Let me flash this one, if I may.
Please do.
It's called Reading the Dream. I don't know where I put it. This is not a very tidy office. Well, I'm not going to show it, but...
I'll put the link below the interview. People will be able to find it.
He figured out that if you try to fight a juggernaut politically, you're going to lose because the power is on the side of the juggernaut. If you fight them culturally, if you just educate people to think differently, then you're preparing for the revolution in the future. And that's what I think is the essence of Miłosz politically, and what reading The Dream, I say it owes a great debt to three people, but the debt to the other two is minuscule compared to the debt to Miłosz, that we had those of us who are not actually in power and just are, you know, getting drunk in a pub talking about things, that we should focus our talk on culture, which we can do something about, rather than about politics, which we can't. And that is the message I'm trying to share myself now in my present book, and which I take away from having worked all this time on the Miłosz book. Now, Miłosz get to answering your question about the differences between us.
Yes.
They did become quite explicit. I got involved in an educational reform movement at Berkeley after the free speech movement, and we came up with the so-called Muscatine Report, which I wrote quite a lot of, quite brashly, considering I didn't have tenure yet. I was the only non-tenured person on that committee. But we got the chance to set up experimental colleges, and we set up Charles Muscatine, who was the chair of the committee, and I, and a third person, we actually set up an experimental college. It went into the College of Letters and Science for approval. And Czesław Miłosz got up and said, who opposed the college, and said, this college is a threat to the cultural traditions of America. I think he assumed I was going to, I don't know, just teach what was Ronald Reagan's phrase, sex, Sex, Drugs, and Treason, something like that. I actually taught Virgil for the first time in my life. And it was part of my education. I never dared teach Virgil because I didn't have any qualifications to be teaching the classics. But then on the other hand, I had no qualifications for teaching English, and I was in the English department. I should have been, if anywhere, in the political science department, but I hate political science. I think it's part of the mechanism of control. So I'm very lucky to have ended up doing these things. Anyway, it's all described in the book how he stopped dealing with me. I think part of it was that I was very, listen, this is a quote from Miłosz that might interest your political listeners, and it led to a disagreement between us. It's from a poem that everyone agrees is a very important poem. It's called in English Dedication, but in Polish it's called Przedmowa, which means introduction. It's an introduction to a very well-composed book of poetry. And it asks the question, what is poetry that does not save nations or peoples? And the answer he gives right away is connivance with official lies. Well, a good deal of poetry is that, either explicitly or more often just implicitly. You learn to be published by not challenging the political system. And then some people do something different and they write political poetry. But most political poetry is not very good poetry, and Yeats gives us the reason why, because Yeats said, a famous quote, out of our quarrels with other people, we make rhetoric. Out of our quarrels with ourself, we make poetry. And Miłosz was a very, very interesting mind. He admitted he was really two people, part conservative and part quite radical. And in his youth, he identified with the radical, and that's why he was willing to give the post-war government a chance. And he actually brought out his whole post-war book of poetry, and the one after it were published under the new regime. And then he came later to see the change happened in Poland, that the Stalinist purge of Poland really happened in 1948. He was in America at that time as a Polish diplomat in America, the way I'd been a Canadian diplomat in Poland. When he came back, he was appalled by what he saw, and he came out and he joined the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which we remember today as a CIA front, and it's true, it was funded by the CIA. And I was a diplomat from 57 to 61, and in that period, it was a bunch of lackeys, really. They were people who knew it was CIA, and they were willing to work with the CIA. But in 50, he technically joined it in 51, and that was the reason he defected in Europe, is so that he could defect in Europe and fight not to change America. He's never had any political designs on America whatsoever. He had political designs on Western Europe. He didn't want Western Europe to go communist the way East Germany and Poland and Hungary and Czechoslovakia significantly had gone. He didn't want to see that happen. And essentially, these were independent people Stephen Spender. Some of these names may not mean very much now. One of them is a key man, James Burnham, and he was technically working for the CIA at that time, but what he really was a former Trotskyite who was appalled at Stalin, the murderer of Trotsky, and it was more like he was using the CIA as a way to fight communism rather than the CIA using him. These were essentially independent people Oh, Mary McCarthy is a name that in America would still ring a bell. Or a man, oh, a very decent man, but I'm too old. I remember the name on the end of the show. These were good people. He joined them, and the Congress of Cultural Freedom in 1951 was very different from the Congress just 6 years later when I saw them, because then the whole CIA thing was known by then.
I suppose I would put it this way, that the part of the contradiction is that in any so-called oppressive regime or any country in a kind of crisis, you're going to find idealistic figures, you're going to find progressives, leftists, trans unionists, creatives, who have their vision for how to resolve those problems or how to get out of that crisis. And you're going to have the CIA there with a checkbook, and you're going to have the US State Department there ready to massage your shoulders and say, carry on. I mean, Vincent Bevin's recent work on how this has played out in so many countries, even in the last 10 years, from Libyan leftists saying, yes, Hillary Clinton, please come and get rid of Gaddafi, to Ukrainian trade unionists today saying, you know, send indiscriminate weapons so we can fight Putin, even though the alternative Ukraine that's being developed is not terribly desirable either. I suppose my question would be, do you think that all those names you've just mentioned, all these wonderful creatives, all of that abstract expressionism that was funded by the CIA,
yes,
do you see that as art that is valuable on its own terms, and these people just ended up in a sort of tragic bind politically? Or do you see it that Milosz's vision for a different Eastern Europe, that Solidarity's vision for a different Poland, that this is still to come?
Yes, well, I do believe it's still to come, right? Mm-hmm. I described in reading The Dream, I say we're in a period of transition, that we had a Pax Americana, which was breaking down, and it's conspicuously breaking down now. I think most Americans don't realize how much all the recent presidents, including the quite decent man Obama, as a man he was good, but as a politician he was totally swamped. He didn't have any base. He was just in debt to Washington ate him up, and he went along with fighting in Afghanistan, that horrible thing in Libya. By the way, I knew a Libyan poet whose father had been murdered by Gaddafi, so he was all for it. That often happens. There was, again, I'm going to forget the name, perhaps you will. He was a leftist and an atheist, and he happened to be in Iraq when Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds. He was among the Kurds at that time, and he was a leftist as he was an active advocate for America going into Iraq. So, and I think that these people were wrong to do that. I think that we've seen these recent American invasions, what we call now forever wars, because as soon as one stops, another one begins. They're bad for the countries invaded. They're also very bad for America, and they're even bad for America power. Even though I want to see a diminution of American power, this is not the way to do it. And there was a vote recently in the third committee of the UN, which I took special interest in, because when I was a diplomat at the UN, I was in the third committee, and I would tell the more famous person in front of me what to do, because I had the instructions from Ottawa. But I was one who got my arm twisted by America. America never lost a vote in the third committee. Recently, just in the last few months, there was a vote in the third committee on a substantive issue related to the whole question of American power. And the vote was the world against eight people: America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, and three more. Ukraine and Israel, of course, because they would be dependent on America. And Lithuania, which had its, they won, as you may say, surprise vote. It's because Lithuania has its own quarrel with independently with Putin right now, which is on their mind. Well, this is what I call the Anglosphere. When we are shrunk down to a vote of eight in the UN for the American position, opposed by the EU, opposed by most NATO countries, you see what's happened to American power. And part of me says, hooray, you know, that's what I wanted to see, is a diminution of that kind of mindless control, because America, well, all politicians, you know, if it's now going to be China or Russia, I don't expect it to be better. I expect they will make the same mistakes. Politicians achieve power by skills which do not equip them to be good at running the rest of the world. And that's why we need to develop, a global public opinion that will world leaders to power the way sometimes public opinion, public opinion stopped the war, helped stop the war in Vietnam, it helped stop the war in Iraq. We need a global public opinion, and I believe that what Miłosz did, in many ways it won't be even time to explain in this show, It is of a great help in helping to prepare for that global public opinion. And I, as I hope in a modest way, I've been able to help too.
I find that answer extremely compelling, and I hope to bring you back to it when we get to the conclusion of this discussion. If I can ask some more specific sort of aesthetic things about Miłosz's poetry. I think what I'm going to do is record some selections, in particular from these main collections of lyric poetry from the 40s, which translates as Rescue, and one from the 50s, which translates as Daylight, so I can give our more committed listeners a sense of what Miłosz was doing in the decades running up to your work with him. When you mentioned that Miłosz in his personality and in his politics had a sort of doubleness of radicalism and conservatism, it strikes me that applies to the sort of duality that you frequently come back to in analysing his poetry, which is the William Blake side of a modern poet and the T.S. Eliot side of a modern poet. These are poets that Miłosz explicitly drew on, and you make a fair bit of the comparison. I mean, your own doctoral work, as I understand it, was on Eliot as well. But perhaps you could say something about the significance of that.
My political science PhD was a dissertation on Eliot, yes, right. And I did think Eliot had a politics, and in retrospect, at the time I didn't understand, because he was obviously not only reactionary, but more seriously anti-Semitic. I met Eliot twice, and both times he assured me that he was not an anti-Semite, and he wanted me to know he was not an anti-Semite. I said, fine. I didn't say this to him, but I said to myself, I hope he lets the world know that he recants what he said about it's undesirable to have too many free-thinking Jews. And he didn't. He never said to the world what he said twice to me. And on the contrary, when one of France's leading anti-Semites, Charles Maurras, died, he wrote an obituary trying to redeem the memory of Charles Maurras at a time when Maurras, during the war, he didn't personally kill anybody, but his denunciation of Jews led to Jews being executed. So I decided that Eliot might be a great poet, but he was also a kind of cynical politician on this anti-Semitism. I see now why I liked Eliot. It's because Eliot was interested in culture. And he did, his prose books are essentially not very interesting, but there is a very moving moment towards the end of his book, The Idea of a Christian Society. He didn't have an idea. There is no idea of a Christian society, really. Unless you want to talk about St. Augustine's City of God or something. But he said, is London, is Western civilization united about anything more than a desire for higher interest rates? And saying that he denounced the materialism of Western culture. And in that he was sincere, and in that I guess I did agree with him. And so now I've lost your question. What was the question again?
It was a question about the role that Blake and Eliot played in Milosz's development, because if Eliot is the highly conservative American emigre who immediately becomes a paid-up high church Anglican over here in Britain, who, as you describe, has had some extremely reactionary things to say, both in his prose writings and in fact in his early poetry. Nonetheless, he did have a curious influence on many people on the left, many prominent people on the British left. Raymond Williams said that he derived a lot of his theory of culture from Eliot's very conservative notes on the definition of culture. Christopher Hill, the Marxist historian, said that he was moved to study the 17th century by what Eliot had said about the metaphysical poets of the 17th century. So you're not alone in being somebody of the left who was drawn early on to Eliot as a subject. Blake, meanwhile, is the libertarian, revolutionary, and visionary poet, kind of the opposite of Eliot's classicism, but they're both there in Milosz.
Yes, right, and particularly Blake, because Milosz wrote in Polish, and he said pointedly for a Polish audience, though it's had a much bigger circulation in English, a book called The Land of Ulro. And Ulro is a word from Blake, essentially this alienated world that we live in now with poverty and the rest of it. But also, that limitations of our vision, we do not see properly in the world of Ulro. So I would say of the two influences, well, first of all, I think they're different in time, because I think Eliot influenced him during the war, and he translated The Wasteland into Polish, and he had a copy of The Wasteland in his hand when he watched Warsaw going up and being exploded by bombs in 1944 with the second Polish uprising. The Jewish uprising was 42, 43, but what we call the Warsaw Uprising usually refers to 44. He escaped with, first of all, only what he could carry with him. And then because everyone was starving in 44, he walked to a place near Kraków, and he was held up, mugged on the way. So he had not even what limited goods he had, he mostly lost. Then he had to dig potatoes for a week to get enough money to eat, to continue walking to Kraków. And that's where he went through a kind of rebirth, I think, and no longer had his old radicalism. And he realized that there was more to the status quo that was about to be banished forever by the arrival of the Soviet army. He did actually go to an old country house, and he was there when the Soviets arrived and killed all the prize breeding cattle just to eat and so on. Miloš experienced the his experiences make him worth reading, and it made him very much, I would say, a believer in Blake. But it's not just that he learned techniques from Blake or something. He, the Blakean vision of a radically different world is one which inspires the book of his, which is closest to being called, quote, a political book, but it's a political book on a cultural level, or you might say even a spiritual level. And he's so much more interesting and complicated than I can squeeze into this kind of format. But I do want to separate that for me, Miloš is not well represented by The Captive Mind. That was a political tract for 1953. And the audience was people in France who were thinking of voting communist, and he didn't want them to. And it's wildly overstated. And I think it's quite, you know, there are five people that he gives as examples of a captive mind. And one of them was a close friend of his who had written a novel, Ashes and the Diamond. It's made a very good movie called Ashes and Diamonds, which I recommend people see. And I think he's very unfair in that book to that man. I never knew the man, but I hadn't read the novel then, but I have since. I had seen the movie, and it's a very powerful movie, and I think a really quite good novel. And Miloš is being propagandistic in The Captive Mind for a political purpose in the, on the ideological level of don't want France to vote communist in 1952, which they could have. I was in Paris in 1948. Almost everyone I talked to there, of course, I only saw one kind of person, but most of them weren't communists, but they expected the communists to win in 1948. And there's a lot of skullduggery, among other things, from the CIA that stopped that from happening. Mostly money, but other things too that stopped that from happening. And I'm glad it didn't happen. I'm glad post-war France was not the same as post-war East Germany.
The book has some very moving moments in it where you're extremely candid about the effect that Miloš's friendship and his sort of unceremonial dropping of you in 1967 had on you. I mean, I don't know how much you want to speak about it now, but I think our listeners would be very interested to hear. Well, I mean, you describe in the book basically being prompted into a depression for several years, and you include three poems that you've written over the course of your life about Miloš, trying to make sense of this relationship and ultimately reconcile this relationship. Is there a sense in which you connect that the end of that relationship with the work that you would go on to do? I can't help but see you as a sort of double of Miloš, somebody who is temperamentally an artist, but who ultimately is so appalled by what they've come to realize about their country or the country that they're in, that they have been forced to pursue that as a subject as well. Maybe you could just sort of tie your own, where your career went after the end of that Miloš relationship into the end of the friendship, if that's the way you see it.
Well, first of all, I have to be a bit more dialectical, because the first poem I wrote was he really broke my heart. Yeah. This was 5 years after we had split up, and I was invited to go to a conference on translation, and there was going to be a panel on translating Miloš, and I was going to be on with two other poets, one of whom was the Poet Laureate of America, and I knew the other two poets, and I was really looking, oh, and Miloš was going to be there, and that's how I would see him again. And I was really looking forward to it. It was going to be at Stanford. And then I got a letter from Stanford saying, they didn't use the word disinvite, but that's what it was. It was a letter telling me I was no longer on that panel. And I phoned and said, what is this? You invite me to be on a panel and then you disinvite me? I've never heard of such a thing. And to be quite frank, I've never heard of it elsewhere. And they said, well, we understand that there have been some problems between you and Mr. Miloš. This was long before the Nobel Prize, by the way. And it was 1982, I think. Well, I know it is because it's the date of my poem. And I didn't want to believe it was Miloš at the time. I thought maybe that something else had happened. I do think it was Miloš now. And anyway, I was brokenhearted and I wrote a poem about being brokenhearted. But Miloš liked the poem. I sent him I sent the poem to Miloš and he liked it. And he said, you know, I don't have much time on Monday. I have to go to the graduation ceremony for the Slavic department. But if you come at 2, we can talk for half an hour. So I came at 2. We talked for 3 hours. And Miloš said, well, we better get up to the graduation. We got up there. Everyone was leaving. And they give people wine to drink at these ceremonies. And we found a tiny bit of wine, like this much in a bottle. And we found 2 paper cups. And we split what was left of the wine. And that was a partial reconciliation. And I saw him again, you know, and other people would visit. And we would both be invited to meet them. So I would see him. It wasn't like the old days. The old days had been like a love affair. This was like two ex-lovers still friends seeing each other. And then when Denise Levertov, another great poet, died, there was a small dinner, commemorative dinner. And Miloš was then very deaf in one ear, and his wife seated me next to him so that I got his good ear. And 2 things happened there. One was he was talking to me about everything that was happening in Poland. And I knew that there was no one else in that room that he could have talked to about those things. He was acknowledging that I had a special relationship to him. And I also got to say, this was just before the river dinner at drinks, I said to him, I want you to know, I admire you. I've been deeply influenced by you. I've changed my life because of you. I am so grateful to you. I need to say I love you. I said that to him. I don't know. I may have said, well, I said, I have a very good friend, Daniel Ellsberg, and I certainly said it to Dan, who we considered, we each say to the other that was my best male friendship was with Daniel Ellsberg. But so I said to him, I love him. But other than that, I never said it to anyone, I think. I remember he was kind of embarrassed. Like a big show of posed chuckle. So it wasn't a permanent break by any means. And that dinner was one of his last public, well, it wasn't public, there were only about 10, but he retired to Poland and eventually died in Poland and is buried in Poland. And I think had a great resplendent revival of poetic inspiration being back where he could be a bard. That's the only word for it. The Polish word is wiesz. But in Poland, bards are important. Bards have kept Poland alive when they didn't have a state. They had 200 years without a state. They only had culture. And the culture was being shaped by poets, particularly Mickiewicz. And Miloš modeled himself on Mickiewicz and quotes a good deal of Mickiewicz. And in the deep organization of his thinking, it's very much like Mickiewicz. It's not going to mean much to people here because Mickiewicz translates. It's very difficult to translate Mickiewicz. But he has a sense that poetry can change the world. And or as he said, poetry not only foresees the future, but speeds its coming. And this may sound like a reactionary thought to Marxists who say that poetry is just, I forget all the language now, but it's the superstructure. It's not the substance of reality. The materialist concept of history is that what matters is how people work with their hands and so on.
We believe in relative autonomy here.
Anyway, Ewosh became a foe of materialism, and he converted me into being. I was certainly never a communist, but I guess I was kind of a Marxist at one stage, and now I think Marxism was defective in terms of culture. And when Marx said he wanted to stand Hegel on its head, or set it right side up, on this very oversimplified level, Hegel said that ideas shape history, and Marx wanted to say, no, history shapes ideas. Well, it's a mix. Ideas are shaped by history, and history is shaped by ideas, and among the ideas are those in particular, I think, the ideas of poets. I believe that.
I think that idealism will surprise, and I hope impress, a lot of your followers who know you as the man who has produced these encyclopedic volumes on the abject and cynical crimes of the United States, right up to the greatest act of mass murder on American grounds, as you've described, 9/11. But I think it was
3 million people maybe in Indonesia.
And that's the subject of a poem of yours as well. That sense of cultural solutions and a spiritual side to all of this hard-headed research is just a crucial component to everything you've done. I wondered if we could close with just the sort of the nutshell version of what it is you're arguing for here, because as I understand it, or as you describe in the book, it was writing this assessment of Milos that made you need to write another volume, offering a kind of vision of why you see an engagement with poetry and culture still as the solution to all of this barbarism that you've spent your life documenting.
Well, in both books, both the Milos book and in Reading the Dream, near the end, I quote John Adams, the second president of the United States, writing to Jefferson. They'd been enemies in politics, and in their old age, they became like me, the survivors of the battles of earlier years. And Adams wrote to Jefferson, the American Revolution wasn't the war. The American Revolution had been won before the war began. It was a revolution in the minds of the people. And it took a generation of work to make that revolution in the minds of the people. And what I want to do, contribute to, because I see it happening, it's already been happening for some time, I think, is to contribute to a revolution in the minds of the people that will say that a violent world in which differences are resolved by wars has to go and has to be replaced by the distinction Hannah Arendt made between coercion and persuasion, the two forms of power. We have to move, it's going to take, maybe millennia to get to any final solution, but to keep diminishing the influence of power by coercion by replacing it by power by persuasion. And then we come back to the great defect now is we're just beginning to get a global public opinion. And I hope that this global public opinion might conceivably force America and Ukraine. Putin has offered to negotiate an exit from this war. And it's quite clear to me if Crimea and the Donetsk, where they speak Russian and feel basically affiliation to Russia, if Ukraine would let go of those provinces and agree not to join NATO, I think Putin has made it pretty clear that the war could end. I think it's America, I think it's Washington, and publicly it's Zelensky. Zelensky's still saying he wants Crimea back, but it was just almost an accident that Crimea, I mean, they say they speak Ukrainian there, but they speak another dialect, which is distinctive from Ukrainian. And I read the memoir of somebody who rode on horseback from Mongolia to Hungary. He rode through Crimea, and everyone was objecting furiously that they had to send their children to schools where the language is Ukrainian because they speak Russian. Why can't Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine go back to Russia? It seems so easy.
I think it was last year a listener of ours pointed out that they'd gone back and listened to the interview I did with you and David Slavik did with you in 2021, and they were amazed to find you were talking about Ukraine then, a year before the invasion. So I just wanted to throw in that I know you've been very, very prescient on what's been going on there. Well, I mean, as we're on to Ukraine, as one of the sort of charismatic examples, both of the overreach of the American state and the American project, and the way in which it seems to be breaking down before our very eyes, but not in the way that anyone of our liberationist persuasion would necessarily have wanted. What about Israel? I mean, how we've spoken to guests on this program, perhaps acquaintances of yours who saw October 7th in your language as a deep event. I wondered if, while we've got you on the tape, you wanted to say anything about the current Israel incursion into Gaza.
Well, I do want to say something. That is, my wife is Jewish, I, out of desire to be on good terms with my wife, I am not saying anything about Israel. And part of me feels like I'm a real coward. But then I think cowardice in the service of love is perhaps permissible. But I will not speak. I mean, anyone can draw their own conclusions from what I say about Ukraine or from the fact that I've said over and over and over on this show that I believe in nonviolence. Yes. I am not explicitly going to say anything.
I have said many times on this program that something we've lost in our political discourse today is an ability to divide between the people we know and love and our political positions. And I respect that. That's a perfectly good explanation. And I think listeners and viewers will indeed draw their own conclusions. Whatever you want to say about it, we've been using your paradigms and your vocabulary in our own analysis on this show over the past few months. Well, Professor Scott, it's an absolute honour to speak to you again, and a real joy as well. I hope that this episode will be regarded as an education in itself by our listeners. It's certainly been that for me. Ecstatic Pessimist is the name of Peter Dale Scott's book on Milosh, and we'll have some links to your more recent exercises. This only came out last year. There's no stopping this man. It's a thrill to speak to you again.
I enjoy it very much. I don't often get a chance to talk about poetry and politics together. It's usually one or the other. Yes. But you want to get to the real me to talk about both at the same time. And so this is a unique opportunity for me, and I'm very grateful. Thank you.
we got it. This is the one.